You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Bottled water is a $300 billion global industry and the most consumed packaged drink worldwide. For many Americans, bottled water has become part of our everyday lives. But that's a pretty recent trend that has grown over the past few decades. Not that long ago, it was a punchline.
Drink the bottled water. I feel silly buying it, though. Maybe I'm just too Midwestern, you know? It's like, whenever I go in a store, I'm always like, hey, how you doing? Yeah, I know I can get water free from any faucet, but I want to pay for it. I'm just curious, do you have any air back there? Or can I buy your garbage? When you think about it, it is water, right? How did we get to the point where we're paying for bottled water? That must have been some weird marketing meeting over in France, you know? Let's just tell the Americans the water's from France. We bought it.
That's comedian Jim Gaffigan doing a stand-up routine back in 2000. So why now do so many Americans spend billions of dollars each year on bottled water? In a new book, our next guest digs into that question and says that bottled water is part of a deeper story of the environment, inequality, and the commodification of a public service. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you drink tap or bottled water at home? Do you buy bottled water when you're dining out or traveling? Have you switched over to carrying a reusable bottle? And were you part of the story a couple decades back when Perrier looked to bottle water here in Wisconsin? Big, long controversy there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Jaffe is Associate Professor of Sociology at Portland State University, where he researches the social, environmental, and economic impacts of bottled and packaged water. His new book is called Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and for Water Justice. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to be here.
Before we dig into the story behind bottled water, I don't know if people really realize the scope and the change that's happened. I remember when, you know, it was kind of like a joke where, so, oh, you've got a glass bottle of Perrier. Ooh, fancy. And now it's this dominant product. Can you talk about the rapid rise?
Sure. Well, I start the book with a story of saying I confess that I'm old enough to remember a time when I was in grade school in the 1980s when, single serve plastic bottled water was really not a product that anybody had thought of yet. Mm-hmm. 1980, Americans consumed just 2 gallons per person per year on average. And it was pretty much, as the comedian said, Perrier in heavy glass bottles, thought of as kind of an odd product. And somehow we got from that to just over 40 years later, Americans consuming 47 plus gallons per person per year on average, 90% almost of Americans consuming some bottled water, and really surprisingly, 1 in 5 Americans refusing the tap entirely when it comes to drinking water and getting all of their drinking water from packaged bottles. And so in researching this book, I was looking into that riddle of how we got there. And I found, just, you know, to sort of preview, that bottled water turns out to not just be kind of a controversial product, which also has a lot of negative environmental impacts that many might be familiar with. But it turns out, and I was surprised to find how deeply connected it is to the social injustice and inequality crisis of uneven access to safe and affordable water, both here in the U.S. And around the world.
I wanted to dig into that big picture. This idea, this debate you set out almost at the beginning, is water a commodity that I can make money by selling in bottles or in other ways versus is water a public right or a public good that we should take the profit motive out of? Could you talk about how that conversation has changed over the last few decades?
Yeah. So beginning, you know, and the form in which many people are more familiar with that struggle over water should be primarily a human right or a commodity provided by the market, has first sort of came to people's mind and awareness in terms of struggles over whether the provision of public tap water should be privatized in places around the world, from Bolivia to Indonesia to cities here in the U.S. Private water companies began taking over the provision of drinking water, and there were a lot of opposition movements that formed in response, private companies taking over an essential service, and water rates would tend to rise, and there were contentions around the quality of the service, and a lot of backlash. And it turns out that while there was a big push for private tap water provision, there is a counter movement, a strong kind of a counterwind. The remunicipalization of many of those systems has taken place. They've come back into public hands. But I think what's gotten less attention is this other major form of what some would call the privatization of drinking water, which is the rise of bottled and packaged water in different forms around the world. And its sort of growth into a global industry, as you say, passing $300 billion. And I think that it turns out to generate its own kind of opposition movements. There's been less attention to it, but I think that it is set to very quickly become the largest, the fastest growing, and the most significant form of the privatization or the, as you say, the commodification of drinking water.
One big development that's turned out to be one of the big problems in bottled water is lightweight plastic. Can you talk about this technological development that really made it so relatively cheap to ship lots and lots of little bottles of water?
Yes, it turns out that the industry was experimenting with plastic water bottles as far back as 1969, actually. But it wasn't until the early 90s that they sort of cracked the code of making this lightweight PET plastic easily producible and sell. You know, so the conversion to PET plastic, that number one plastic lightweight bottles, began. And I think if you remember back to the 90s, those who were around, suddenly it seemed like everything was being sold in plastic instead of glass. And PET really was the development, the technological development, that allowed the industry to mass produce this product. And production and consumption grew very rapidly. And then bottled water became very big business, and the big food and beverage companies got involved. And so, not coincidentally, in the 90s, when was also when you saw the big soda makers, Pepsi and Coke, get into the business with Dasani and Aquafina, and they and Nestle and Danone began buying up smaller bottlers around the country and around the world. And those four firms, the big four, I call them, have led the market both here at home and around the world ever since.
Talking to Daniel Jaffe about his new book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and For Water Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. Daniel, one big point here. With the early days of bottled water, it was like, oh, this is fancy stuff from a spring, you know, artesian wells, whatever. That's not mostly what we're drinking in the United States. Where is our water? When we buy that bottle of water, where is it usually coming from?
Right. So the packaging portrays usually pristine springs or lakes and a snow-clad mountain in the background. But in reality, over the last few decades, the makeup of bottled water has shifted to the point where in the U.S. now, only just a little over a third of bottled water comes from groundwater at all, springs or any other form. And almost two-thirds, something like 63% of bottled water sold on the shelves is taken simply from municipal water systems, from the city water systems in different communities. It is taken out, refiltered. The companies strip out the mineral content, and then they add their own sort of proprietary mineral mixes, which, you know, give it their trademark taste, so that, you know, for example, Dasani would taste the same in Wisconsin as it would in New York State and California, which I think incidentally has probably contributed to training people's palates and maybe is one of the reasons why some people express dissatisfaction with the taste of their tap water. But so, yes, the vast majority of bottled water in the U.S. now is coming actually simply from public tap systems, but it is, of course, being sold for either hundreds to thousands of times the cost. And I will add that on top of the cost difference, the environmental impact is quite significant. One study calculated that bottled water's energy impact is about 1,000 to 2,000 times higher per gallon than providing tap water. And then the overall environmental impact, counting all different factors, is somewhere between, newer study, somewhere between 1,400 and 3,500 times higher. So it is a product with a very big ecological footprint, and that's not even to mention the plastic waste crisis on a global level.
let's mention that plastic issue. Now, I think we might think, okay, I buy that plastic bottle, I drink it, I drop it in the bin, gets recycled, it'll show up in the next bottle of water. Mm. You did find it in water on the shores, I think in Thailand, Daniel, that this is a big plastic problem, these single-use bottles.
Yeah, I mean, that was my first exposure to this, really, this global disaster, I think, the ecological disaster of single-use plastic pollution, just in a place where the shore off of an island was coated in a floating mass of plastic, mostly bottles, but other garbage as well, for several hundred feet out. But it turns out that globally, people are consuming between 600 and 700 billion single-use plastic bottles of all beverages. But because bottled water is by far the top selling packaged beverage around the world, it contributes the largest share to that marine waste problem. And one study found that bottles and their caps, the beverage bottles and their caps, are the number one marine garbage item. Another study found that they accounted for almost 50% of all marine waste. So dealing with the global single-use plastics issue really requires dealing with the problem of single-use beverages, but also particularly packaged water. And the U.S. recycling rate is actually quite low for these bottles. It's gone down over the years. It's down to about 26% of bottles were recycled. Most of those do not get turned into new bottles. Only something like 7 to 10% do. The rest are sort of what's called downcycled. They become, you know, carpets or whatever, less high-quality products. And around the world, the bottle recycling rate is much lower. It's something like 7 to 9%.
Talking to Daniel Jaffe about his new book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and For Water Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you avoid plastic water bottles? What led you to do that, if so? Or are they more convenient? Do you maybe trust it more than the tap water at your home or place of work? What questions do you have about the rise of this bottled water industry? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Daniel Jaffe about the bottled water industry and his new book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and For Water Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Christina is with us in Glenwood City. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. More often than not, I get my water in glass bottles, spring water. I want to confirm that when it says spring water, is that in fact spring water and not purified?
Christina, thanks for the call. Daniel, you write in the book that regulations, especially if water doesn't cross state lines, are non-existent or vague at best?
Right. Well, about the question of spring water labeling, the FDA, so bottled water, it's worth noting, is treated as a foodstuff and it's regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. The FDA does have specific regulations about what can be called spring water. It's fairly liberal. It can involve getting groundwater in many different ways. Whether companies are abiding by those regulations, I have no way of knowing, but there is at least a legal definition that they have to be held to. But in contrast to FDA regulation of bottled water, the regulation of tap water systems, our public tap water, is falls under the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. And, you know, it's worth noting that the difference between those two, I sort of say, is effectively the difference between night and day. There's a pretty dramatically uneven playing field between the bottled water industry and public tap water providers in terms of the regulatory structures they're under, not so much in terms of the contaminants that they're allowed to have. They're held to roughly the same maximum levels of contaminants, but EPA regulation is far more rigorous. Tap water utilities have to test their water more often and have to critically report to the public when they find contamination almost immediately, and also publish annual reports. Whereas bottled water companies, the concern is that they test the water themselves. The FDA does inspect plants, but it has a diminishing number of inspectors. And there's been some interesting reporting on this by Consumer Reports and other outlets looking at the weakness of the bottled water regulatory regime. Overall, it's very, very unlikely that consumers will find out if and when the bottled water they're consuming has contamination found. On top of that, I'll just add one more thing around bottled water safety, which is that peer-reviewed academic studies have found recently that bottled water contains higher levels of microplastic fragments. And one academic study found that somebody consuming only bottled water would consume 22 times more microplastic fragments than someone who consumed only tap water. So there is a difference in the regulation and in what the, and what they contain.
Christina, thanks for the call. Mike joins us now in Hudson. Mike, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, two things to note. I guess one, I've always had a strong preference of things out of a glass versus plastic. So I've not ever been an adopter of the plastic bottle consumer part. But the other question I have is how much of an impact are these water refilling stations having? I just traveled abroad to the UK and Ireland, and I was surprised to not see very many of them.
Mike, thanks for the call. Daniel, these you read about this in the book. These have sprung up in a lot of places. Have these water refilling stations changed sales of bottled water?
So I'm going to assume that the caller is talking about refilling points, water refilling points like water fountains. In other words, getting your tap water out of a water refiller. In that case, so that is it's really happening in a lot of the wealthy nations and spreading around the world. The sort of the increasing what I call the reclaiming the tap segment of the movements responding to bottled water's growth, and that is a really fascinating kind of constellation of efforts that have happened between city governments, nonprofit organizations, universities, other public and private institutions, the last decade or more to sort of turn back to tap water. Cities saying, hey, you know, we are the providers of this tap water and we know it's really clean. And what does it make any sense for us to be purchasing bottled water for our city government offices or allowing it to be sold, say, on city property and public parks? And a growing number of cities, large ones from San Francisco to LA to New York and others, but a lot of small communities, counties around the country, and really around, you know, U.S., Canada, Europe, and beyond, are starting to enact bans on purchasing or selling bottled water on city property. And then the flip side, that sort of required two-step dance that they do if they ban it in some places, is to then expand access to clean public tap water, free public tap water in public places. And I think that's one of the most interesting and dynamic parts of what's going on is these communities are rolling out hundreds of shiny new hydration stations, public water fountains, refill points, and then private businesses are getting in on the act. There are networks where businesses have stickers in their windows. There are apps. One big app is called the Refill app. It comes from a nonprofit group based in the UK, but it now has gone global. It has 300,000 refilling points on its app, so you can like look to find out what the nearest place you can get a free refill. Sometimes it's in a coffee shop that won't make you buy anything. They'll just give you free water. And that's sort of taking off as a movement, and it has actually gotten the attention of the bottled water industry, and they are concerned. I do a lot of reading of market literature and market reports, and the industry is concerned. And they say particularly young folks, but across the board, people turning back to the tap is making a dent in sales. I just looked at the latest statistics last week in the US. For the first time since the Great Recession, bottled water consumption actually fell by one report, by 1%. And that's new. And I think at least some of that change owes to these movements that are taking interest in reclaiming the tap. I quote one representative from a bottled water company who told a conference, quote, the water bottle has in some ways become the mink coat or the pack of cigarettes. It's socially not very acceptable to the young folks, and that scares me, unquote. So the industry is alert to this, and they are concerned.
Mike, thanks for the call. Daniel, in our last couple minutes, another part of the story I want to get into. You looked at the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, and some other places. Some of the bottled water marketing material, internal material you mentioned, talks about, hey, this is maybe a growth opportunity if people don't trust their water. And you worry that that's going to lead maybe to lack of trust in municipal water and disinvestment in public water supplies. Can you take our last couple of minutes and talk about that?
Yeah, that's very important. So a counter trend to what I just described, this sort of turning back to the tap among people in communities that have the privilege of, you know, high quality tap water, which is the vast majority of U.S. drinking water utilities, by the way. But a small percentage, very small, 7-8% at the absolute most of U.S. water systems do have some water quality health related violation within any given year. And those problems are not evenly distributed. They tend to fall disproportionately in certain kinds of communities, low income communities, rural communities, and overwhelmingly communities with predominantly populations of people of color, African Americans and Latinos in particular. And those, it turns out, are the social groups who also distrust their tap water the most, and who have turned to buying bottled and packaged water the most. And the industry is aware of this. And so what we actually now have, I think, is, and rather than sort of say people are misinterpreting, because obviously if 20% of people are not drinking tap water, but it's only, you know, 7% or 8% of the systems have a violation, some people are turning away from perfectly good water. But rather than say there's a misperception, I think we could see that as a logical reading of the uneven distribution of risks. And so I argue that, you know, when we have, I think that bottled water is in these communities is serving to increase economic and racial inequalities sort of between the clean water haves and have-nots. And I think we're only going to really be able to resolve this distrust and problem and the deterioration problem from underfunding of public water systems by restoring that federal role. The federal government used to fund it at a much higher level, going back to strong federal funding that will bring up the quality and restore the quality of water systems across the board so that everyone will view tap water once again as trustworthy.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
That's Daniel Jaffe, Associate Professor of Sociology at Portland State University. We've been talking about his latest book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and for Water Justice. Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org, stream live, or check out or share archived copies of conversations here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can also download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, the state Senate passed a Republican-sponsored bill yesterday that would ban providing certain types of gender-affirming medical care to people under the age of 18. Governor Tony Evers has promised to veto that bill. It's part of a nationwide wave of legislation on transgender issues, and advocates for transgender youth say even bills that don't become law can send a negative message. Our next guest has been following research on the impact of gender-affirming medical care and the politics related to it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this bill to ban this gender-affirming medical care for minors here in Wisconsin? Would you like to see the governor veto it, as he has said he would, or sign it? Are you or a friend or family member transgender and or seeking the kind of care we're talking about? What is your perspective on this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Alethea Zamatakis is a research assistant professor at Northwestern University's Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being, with a focus on translational health for LGBTQ+ populations. Alethea, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Your research, I understand, focuses on health care, but the issue of transgender care has entered the political arena. I understand you're trying to stay on top of current legislation around the country. Can you talk about what you're seeing here in Wisconsin and how it fits into this wider wave of legislation in states?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing in Wisconsin is very similar to what's happening across numerous other states. Wisconsin, as you mentioned, is seeking to pass two bills that would ban gender-affirming care for minors and also ban doctors from performing gender-affirming care on minors and revoking their licenses if they do so. This is fairly in line with 22 other states that have banned gender-affirming care so far, primarily in the South as well as in the Midwest, and 5 other states that have also made it a felony to provide such care. And so this is really part of a larger pattern of an assault on transgender health and transgender people across the country.
Now, some of the lawmakers in favor of the bill have used terms like mutilation to describe gender-affirming care, referring, I think, to some of the surgeries that might be involved in gender-affirming care. Can you talk us through, though, what gender-affirming medical care consists of for minors of different ages?
Yeah, so gender-affirming care for minors doesn't begin until somewhere between 9 to 12 years old, depending on when an individual starts to go through puberty. For individuals that young, what would happen is they would be prescribed puberty blockers, which essentially delay puberty. They don't prevent puberty. They don't change anything permanently about the body. They just simply stop puberty from happening until the child goes off the blockers. And this allows them the time then to wait until they're about 15 years old, and at that time decide whether they want to go on hormone replacement therapy in order to develop breasts and, for example, to not develop a deeper voice or other quote-unquote masculine features for transgender girls, or to go on testosterone and start to develop facial hair, broader facial features, for example, for transgender boys. Transgender kids really in general do not have surgeries. Most places, especially in Wisconsin, do not provide gender-affirming surgeries to individuals under 18. Children's Wisconsin, for example, only provides gender-affirming top surgery to patients 18 and older, and the same goes for UW Health. For any type of gender-affirming care that children are receiving, they have to first undergo extensive evaluation by therapists and social workers, providers, receive parental support. And, you know, this isn't happening, as some legislators have tried to say, to 3-year-olds or 4-year-olds. Gender-affirming care isn't something in this way that is needed until they reach puberty. Otherwise, gender-affirming care looks like providing children with access to therapy and social workers to help them cope with a world that, you know, really isn't made for other kids like them.
Alethea Zematakis is with us from Northwestern University's Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being, talking about gender-affirming medical care after the state legislature passed a ban on that kind of care for people under 18. The governor expected to veto it. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions or maybe your own experiences in your family at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alethea, when it comes to starting on puberty blockers, people might hear, okay, age 9 to 12. That's pretty young for a pretty big decision, even if made with in consultation with parents and healthcare professionals. Can you talk about a little more about what goes into that decision in that age range?
Yeah, so really what goes into the decision is extensive consultation with the parent and the child to ensure that they fully understand what is happening, that they understand that, you know, this is not just a decision that they are coming into one day and changing the next, but that this is something extensive, and that they will have to continue to come in and receive ongoing monitoring. There are extensive psychological examinations to evaluate essentially whether a child is experiencing what's called gender dysphoria, or in other words, a sort of anxiety that results from a mismatch between how one sees themselves and what their body looks like. And those evaluations, you know, work to suss out if there are issues of body dysmorphia or gender dysmorphia, whether depression or anxiety or other co-occurring mental health concerns might be factoring into the child's concerns at the moment. And then only after those consultations is the child able to actually begin puberty blockers.
What do we know about research when it comes to, you know, the impact of starting puberty blockers for that kid, say age 9 to 12, versus somebody in the same position with gender dysphoria who doesn't get that? What are the trade-offs? What are the pros and cons of doing it versus not doing it?
Yeah, the benefits of doing it are huge. Gender-affirming care not only is highly safe, but individuals undergoing care as children have enormous benefits. Studies have found that transgender youth who receive such care are 60% less likely to develop depression, 73% less likely to be suicidal. Gender-affirming care also boosts overall mood and happiness. It boosts and enhances relationship stability, ability to really focus and participate in school. And it additionally, you know, ensures that these effects remain over their lifetime. For transgender adults who begin gender-affirming care later in life because they didn't have access to it as a child, there can be an increase in distress in terms of that gender dysphoria because of differences that have emerged because of puberty, such as a deeper voice, which is something that really, for the most part, can't be surgically treated. And so puberty blockers really allow a child to have control over what their body will look like in the future. And as I said, the effects are entirely reversible of puberty blockers. So if a child starts them and at 15 or 16 or 17 says, actually, I want to go through puberty the way my body otherwise would have, they are able to stop puberty blockers and fully begin the process of puberty as they otherwise would have. Children are extensively monitored for any minimal side effects, such as there can be slight calcium loss, for example, but there are ways to prevent that and treat that that doctors really watch out for. And we know that research tracking transgender people has found that only 1% of trans people actually experience any type of regret from receiving this type of care as children or as adults, which is much lower than many other types of care that is regularly provided without any attempts to ban it by legislators.
We're talking to Alethea Zamatakis, research assistant professor at Northwestern University's Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being. She's helping us understand a bill that would ban gender-affirming medical care for youth in Wisconsin and how it affects transgender people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Thoughts on this effort in the state legislature? Do you want to see the governor block it or no? If you're a medical professional, do you work with the LGBTQ plus community? Do you do some of the treatments that we're talking about, if you'd care to share your experience? Or if you've been through this yourself as a parent, a child, please call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Alethea Zamatakis, research assistant professor at Northwestern University's Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being, talking with her about a bill that, if it were signed into law, would ban gender-affirming medical care for minors in Wisconsin, passed both chambers with Republican backing in the legislature. Governor Evers, Democrat, expected to veto the bills. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Another few minutes if you want to join in. Do you have questions about gender-affirming medical care? What the Wisconsin bill would and wouldn't do? What do you want to see happen? Is this affecting your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alethea, I know there are concerns about whether or not bills like these end up becoming law. The fact of their introduction being seen as sending a message to transgender youth and their families, the trans community as a whole. What do you see the potential impact there?
Yeah, the impact is huge. We know from other states that have worked to pass similar legislation that even when it's vetoed by the governor, you know, these types of bills send transgender children and their families into a state of panic. Families have to question, you know, do I need to find a job elsewhere? Do we need to move? How do I take care of my child? And most people can't afford to just pick up and move across state borders. And so then, you know, for parents who are trying to be supportive systems for their children, that's a high level of distress to know that really there is nothing in that moment you can do to protect your child from legislators who are seeking to pass bills further oppressing them. For children themselves, transgender kids already have higher rates of depression, anxiety, and suicidality than non-transgender children. And these types of bills only increase those rates by telling children that people like them are not wanted here, are not welcome here, are seen as mentally ill, are seen as having bodies that are quote unquote mutilated. You know, very dehumanizing language that is used in order to refer to transgender people in order to pass these bills that really affects the ongoing health of transgender children and adults. But also, in addition to that, as legislators attempt to pass these bills, they spread a ton of misinformation. You know, when they speak about children 3 years old receiving surgeries, when they speak about these surgeries as mutilation, when they speak about gender-affirming care as somehow lacking evidence, despite the backing of numerous studies detailing that it is a fully safe and beneficial process. This type of information is spread to the public, and the public then spreads it to other people that they know. And this misinformation spreads like wildfire, further perpetuating these myths, this misinformation, and this dehumanizing language beyond just the legislature.
We are talking about gender-affirming medical care. A bill in Wisconsin would ban it. Governor Evers expected to veto it. There concerns been raised by Republican sponsors of this bill, Alethea, that, yes, the medical community opposes this ban for the most part in Wisconsin. Republicans arguing that research can change, views can change, and that we may change our mind on this. What do you think of that?
100% research can change. But in terms of whether or not research changes to say that gender affirming care is no longer beneficial, that is just entirely implausible. Numerous studies have evaluated thousands of transgender youth and adults across the country, and not just in the United States, but in other countries as well. And this research continues to show the same effects and the same level of safety of these procedures. The reality is that any changes in research regarding gender-affirming care will be research studying how to enhance this care, research studying how to ensure better access to this type of care, not research finding that gender-affirming care is suddenly no longer beneficial. That's simply not how the science works.
Time for one quick call. Elise is with us in Ashland. Elise, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to bring up?
Fantastic. Well, just that, you know, I've been seeing these bills come up in so many different states. I live in Wisconsin. I'm trans. And my boyfriend lives in Missouri. My fiance, actually, lives in Missouri, and he's trans the other direction. And just saying it's about kids is always such a stalking horse, right? Because we've seen this come up in so many other states, and in many of them, they say, oh, it's a ban for minors, but they define minors as anyone under 26 or anyone under 30. And then in Missouri a few weeks ago, the attorney general unilaterally banned it for everyone, including adults. Now, that was ultimately struck down by the courts. But, I mean, you know, we can see this is their goal. And this is not.
Elise, we just have a few moments left. Thanks for calling. Alethea, this spreading, and that's true in some states, as Elise says, to older ages as well.
Yes, 100% true. And primarily for transgender adults, these bans are attempting ban the care being provided through Medicaid, for example. And so really what we see is that legislators will continue to attack trans children, will continue to attack poor trans people, and will continue to spread this further as an ongoing assault on transgender people.
Alethea, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Alethea Zamatakis, research assistant professor at Northwestern University's Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-Being. We talked to her about legislation that would ban gender-affirming medical care for minors in Wisconsin. It passed the legislature. Governor Evers is expected to veto it. Participation in high school football in Wisconsin declined more sharply than in any other state over a 10-year period. This year, some high school football teams have had to forfeit games. Other schools are fighting they no longer have enough players to finish out their seasons. Corrine Hess reports on how schools are adapting to fewer kids playing football.
It's homecoming at Bigfoot High School in Walworth County, and the stands are packed with parents and students gathered to watch their team crush Monroe.
And now the starting lineup for your Bigfoot Williams Bay Chiefdogs.
Before the game, student Valak Channing says he's feeling confident about his school.
We're gonna catch a dub here. We're gonna mercy roll these kids.
But this homecoming game is different. This year, the Friday night lights are shining down on the boys' varsity soccer team. Bigfoot's homecoming football game and the two games leading up to it were canceled. Bigfoot only has six seniors on its football team, and key players got hurt. District Administrator Doug Parker says, ideally, each class would have about 15 football players. But over the last several seasons, fewer kids are playing.
If we had JV kids that were eligible to play, we would. But we're not going to put a 5'1", 110-pound freshman on a varsity football field just to play a varsity game.
Bigfoot is not alone. Wisconsin saw a nearly 25% decrease in 11-player football from 2009 to 2019, according to the latest data available from the National Federation of State High School Associations. That's the largest decline in high school football participation in the country. The reason for the decrease in participation is hard to pinpoint. Experts say one factor could be anxiety about concussions. In some cases, boys may be choosing to play a different fall sport, such as soccer or volleyball. And some decline in participation may be because high schoolers prefer screens to sports. In Wisconsin, boys' soccer participation is up about 4% over the last decade, while boys' volleyball is up about 20%. But those fall sports still draw far fewer players than football. Most states have seen fall participation decline. A few, including Texas, have seen slight increases. Krista Niehoff heads the federation that tracked this data. She believes when new participation numbers are released, football will still be at the top of its game nationally.
Overall, interest in the sport of football is healthy. We're not sure about what's happening in Wisconsin.
Todd Clark with the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association says the biggest drop in football participation was between 2012 and 2016. That coincides with more media coverage of contact sports causing concussions. Since then, Clark says the number of football participants has flatlined. Clark says schools with strong football programs have tended to see less drop-off in participation.
It hasn't been a secret. Successful programs draw kids in because people like to win.
At Bigfoot, the soccer team was more than happy to take the homecoming spotlight for the evening. Looking out at the stands before the game, soccer star Hudson Torres says he had never seen so many fans.
I mean, football has always been the big sport. I mean, we won state in like 2009 for football. So, I mean, it's good to see a different change with soccer now. We're ranked 9th in the state, so I think people are starting to really like come and enjoy the games.
For the most part, parents and students didn't mind the change either. Nicole Raskin, who is a student council advisor and the parent of a senior, says making the switch to soccer was the best solution the school could come up with.
As a parent, we have heard only positive. Every single comment said, we hope our football players get healthy, and we're very excited to see the soccer team get this experience.
And even without the football game, Bigfoot High School was able to keep their homecoming traditions alive. They crowned the homecoming queen and king at halftime, and as predicted, the team won their game. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can find that story and more Wisconsin news online at WPR.org. And you can check out archives of our conversations here on the Ideas Network, including, I just looked this up, from 2018, did an interview about a lot of Wisconsin schools moving to 8 players on a side versions of football for related reasons to that news story. Find all that at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson joins the show for a look at the latest news in the U.S. Senate and efforts to prevent future risks of government shutdown, including some legislative changes he is calling for. Then you could check out a Milwaukee restaurant that's getting some national attention on a New York Times food list. Then get an update on the latest in the war between Israel and Hamas. That's all coming up tomorrow morning. It starts at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Living in Wisconsin, do you think we're part of the Midwest? For most of us, the answer is yes, according to a new survey, though we're not the most Midwestern of the Midwest. I saw this in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The Emerson College Survey Center and the Midwest Review teamed up. They polled a bunch of people in 22 states in the general, roughly north-central part of the U.S. Do you consider yourself to live in the Midwest? Here in Wisconsin, 93.6% of us said, yeah. Pretty high, but not number one. Iowa and Minnesota residents were up over 96%. The least Midwestern states, no surprise, were on the fringes of the survey. Only 9% of Pennsylvanians said they were in the Midwest. The biggest surprise to me, 2/3 of people in Oklahoma said they were in the Midwest. That's on the border of Texas. That's pretty far south from my version of the Midwest. But I guess, hey, it's a Midwestern state of mind. This is Central Time.